four, three, two, one. Boom, and we're live. 12 rules for life. So without reading this, so what you're saying is... That's what I like.
There's only 12 things you need to know in life, right? That's it?
Yeah. Well, yeah, yeah. This this interview that you just did with this woman, Kathy Newman, was that in the UK?
It was. Channel 4, UK.
I just went... I felt bad, but I was also laughing. I went to her Twitter page to read, like, and in with each one of her tweets, no matter what she says, someone writes underneath it. So what you're saying is, and then some ridiculous, but by the way, your fans were mocking her, but politely, non-aggressively. I didn't read any rude things. Like, there was no insults, or there was, well, maybe a few insults, but there's no swears. It was just playful mocking of the interview that she did with you, because the interview was ridiculous. It was a ridiculous interview. I mean, I listened to it or watched it several times. I was like, this is so strange. It's like her determination to turn it into a conflict. It's one of the issues that I have with television shows.
Yeah.
Because they have a very limited amount of time, and they're trying to make things as salacious as possible. They want to have these sound bites, these clickbait sound bites. And she just went into it incredibly confrontational, not trying to find your actual perspective, but trying to force you to defend a non-realistic perspective.
Yes, well, I was the hypothetical villain of her imagination, essentially. Yeah. Well, what happened was interesting, too, the way it played itself out, because I met her in the green room beforehand. You know, she was being made up, and then they put a little bit of powder on me, and we had a friendly kind of interchange, and then we went and sat in front of the cameras and for a couple of minutes, you know, before the show got rolling, and we had a pretty pleasant back and forth, and then as soon as the cameras went on, she was a completely different person.
Ugh.
And I thought, oh, I see.
It's a trick.
I see what's going on.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, so that kind of alerted me to, well, the fact that there was something rotten in the state of Denmark, let's say. Yeah, but, you know, this is also why YouTube is going to kill TV. Because television, by its nature, all of these narrow broadcast technologies, they rely on forcing the story, right? Because it has to happen now. It has to happen in, like, often in 5 minutes. Because they only broadcast 5 minutes of that interview. They did put the whole thing up on YouTube.
To their credit.
It hasn't ceased to amaze me yet. I think that they thought that the interview went fine. That's the scuttlebutt I've got from sort of behind the scenes, because I know some people who know what's going on at Channel 4, and they're shell-shocked by the response. You know, and then, of course, there was the counter response. The Guardian the next day published an article saying that, you know, the head of Channel 4 had to call in police security because of threats. You know, well, first of all, you can call the police in about anything. And they never did detail out exactly what the threats were. You know, but then about 20 newspapers picked that up and went for Kathy Newman is now being harassed by an army of online trolls for doing nothing but doing her job. And then there was a backlash against that in the press. And so it's been
Someone took an audit of the actual interchanges that...
Yeah.
Between fans and her. And there was way more negative ones coming your way.
Yes. That were seriously negative. Yeah, that's right.
Seriously negative, violent, harassing, just rude. There were way more.
Yeah.
And no one picked up on that at all. It was all the narrative was she's a victim.
Yeah.
Even though she was highly aggressive in this. But
She's a funny victim. It's not like she's not successful.
Yeah.
You know, it's like at some point you think you should have to hand in your victim card. I think like when you go to an Ivy League university, it's like right then and there.
You get
to
hand in.
Yeah, because you don't get to be oppressor and oppressed at the same time. That's just too much.
Well, one of the things that you pointed out was when you were talking about competition for very lucrative jobs, and you were saying, look what you've done. Like, you must have had to work here. And she proudly was saying how hard she had to work to get there. I'm like, well, yes, of course. No one's going to hand this to you.
No, this definitely is why, not.
And this is why you were saying you are opposed to equality of outcome.
I can't imagine anything we could possibly strive for in our society that would make it into hell faster than equality of outcome. Like the historical evidence for the pathology of that route is so strong. It's like you have to be historically ignorant beyond belief or malevolent or resentful beyond comprehension in order to think that that's a good idea. Argue for that.
I agree with you, but I think that even if you came into this with no knowledge of history, but a complete understanding of human beings, you would say, well, that doesn't make any sense. And one of the best quotes that I've ever read about it is that if you have real true freedom, you're never going to have equality of outcome. Because with real true freedom, you have the freedom to not
to
engage.
Differ.
Well, look, if you look at a guy like Jeff Bezos, for instance, that Amazon guy who's worth more money than anybody ever, right? That guy works all day.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a maniac.
Oh, yeah.
He's acquiring all these different companies, and everything he's doing is designed to succeed.
Yeah.
I mean, he's just
fanatical
about it.
Well, that's what Gates just said, too, in a recent interview. And I know some guys that are, you know, they're in approximately the same universe as those two, and they just work all the time.
That's all they do.
All the time.
Yeah.
And they don't just work. They work so efficiently and so effectively. And make use of every second in ways you can't even imagine unless you're in that sort of position. So, and you know, doing that doesn't mean that you will succeed, but not doing it certainly means that you will fail.
Well, not doing it certainly means you will never achieve that level of success, and that's what we're talking about. We're talking about equality of outcome.
Yeah.
I don't want that. I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to work like that. I don't want to do what he's doing. And I should have the freedom to not do that.
Yeah.
As he should have the freedom to do that. If we're going to play this game called capitalism, which we're all agreeing is probably at least in as far as the models that we have right now is the best one that we have. If we're all going to play this game, if someone decides to be the Michael Jordan of capitalism, you can't stop them.
Mm-hmm.
You can't say, no, you're playing this game too well. You're playing this game too hard. You're too obsessed with this game. You're going to have that.
Yeah, you can stop them. You can try to stop people from winning crookedly,
yes.
Which is what you should do. And,
yes.
You know, there's a couple of things that are really worth delving into with regards to that, too, because there's this sort of Marxist notion that all this inequality is generated as a consequence of capitalism. And that's actually technically false, because if you look at there seems to be something like a law of nature that's described by this statistical model called the Pareto distribution. And it basically suggests that in any creative domain, there's going to be a small number of people will do almost all of the output. But it doesn't just apply to human beings. It applies to the heights of trees in the Amazon rainforest. It applies to the size of cities, and it applies to the mass of stars, it's something like the more you have, the more you get. It's something like, you can imagine how that would work with a star. As it gets bigger and bigger and its gravitational mass increases, it's going to attract more and more matter. And then as a city grows, well, more and more people are excited to move there because of all the opportunities. And so some cities start to grow tremendously and others don't. But this phenomena where a small number of people end up controlling a tremendous proportion of the resource is not only limited to money, and it doesn't only occur in capitalist societies. It occurs everywhere. It's like a natural law. So you see the same thing with number of points scored by a spectacular sports figure. There's always a tiny proportion of people who are way ahead on the curve, or people who make records, or people who sell paintings, or people who compose music, or people who sell music online. It's all the same. It's the 1% gets 80%. And so, well, first, we can't blame that on capitalism. And second, we should note that it actually does constitute a problem, which is what the left-wingers are always jumping up and down about, right? Like, too much inequality starts to destabilize your society. And it isn't obvious how to shovel money from the top end, maybe the 0.1% who have almost all the money, down to the people who have almost nothing in a way that's effective, so that they don't get thrown out of the game completely and so that the whole society doesn't destabilize. We don't exactly know how to do that. It is a problem because inequality does exist and it does tend to magnify across time. And then there's another problem too, which we haven't figured out, is imagine that in order to make everyone rich, you have to tolerate a certain amount of inequality. That seems obvious. We don't know how many units of inequality you need to tolerate per unit of wealth generated, but the answer is definitely not zero. It's definitely not zero. So,
yeah, so it goes back to this equality of outcome idea.
Yeah.
And this thing has perplexed me since I've met you and since you were involved in this original debate over gender pronouns. And there was an article that was written recently. I forget the exact title of it. I think it was something along the lines of, why can't people hear what Jordan Peterson is saying?
Yeah.
You are misrepresented more than anyone I know in a weird way. You are villainized in a weird way where I can't believe that these people are honestly looking at your opinions and coming up with these conclusions. I can't help but feel like what is happening is people are consciously deciding to ignore reality and paint you as this archetypal figure of oppressive white male patriarchy, ignorance, fill in the blank with all the rest of the descriptives that you'd like to use. But they've decided to paint you in this way, like as a target, mm-hmm. because they need a target to sort of reinforce this idea that transgender people are being victimized and women are being victimized. And
Even deeper, that the right narrative is the way that we should view the world is victim versus oppressor, because that's the basic postmodern neo-Marxist template. It's the right way to view the world is that it's a power ground. It's a battleground of power interests competing constantly. The ones that win are oppressors. The ones that lose are oppressed. That's the way you look at the world. And I think that that's wrong. That's a bad way of looking at the world psychologically, sociologically, politically, economically, ideologically, you name it. Now, it ends in nothing but catastrophe. I mean, first of all, because it puts your group identity as something that's paramount. And I mean, that's just not, that isn't what we do in the West, let's say. We put your individual identity paramount. And then, that's just for starters, fundamentally. And then I guess the other reason that people are on my case to some degree is because I have made a strong case, which I think is fully documented by the scientific literature, that there are intrinsic differences, say, between men and women. And I think the evidence in that, this is the thing that staggered me, is that no serious scientists have debated that for like four decades. That argument was done by the time I went to graduate school. Everyone knew that human beings were not a blank slate, that biological forces not parameterized the way that we thought and felt and acted and valued. Everyone knew that. The fact that this has become somehow debatable again is just, especially because it's being done by legislative fiat, they're forcing it. To me, as a scientist, and in the States too, with Title IX, for example, because Title IX is sort of predicated on that viewpoint.
What is Title IX?
Title IX was originally just a piece of legislation that mandated that female sports teams were funded to the same degree that male sports teams were funded in American universities. But it's been expanded out so that if there's any differences in any areas whatsoever between the genders, then the universities are being taken to court. And like 200 of them, last I looked, about 200 of them were up, and they can have their funding revoked if they violate the Title IX provisions. So it's become like a vicious weapon for social justice warrior equality of outcome types.
And so it's not just about sports.
No, it's got way, way beyond that. Yeah, it's become an equality of outcome issue fundamentally.
There was an article that I sent you. One of them was from, I think... I got it off of dig.com, but it was Jordan Peterson is having his moment and we should ignore him. Mm-hmm. I sent this to you and there was
the last part of that might be true. But.
One of the things in the article was citing this study that showed very little difference between men and women.
Oh, yeah, I read that damn study. Yeah. Oh, God, it's a pathetic study.
Yeah, well, I sent it to you because I was like, this is not right.
Well, the thing is, like most things, it's complicated.
Yes.
You know, so are men and women more similar or more different? Well, it depends on how you define the terms first. But they're more similar. Well, why? Well, they're the same species. So we could start with that. But the question is, what are the differences and how do they manifest themselves and are those manifestations important? So here's an example. If you took a random woman out of the population and a random man, and you had to bet on who was more temperamentally aggressive. If you bet on the man, you'd be right 60% of the time. But you'd be wrong 40% of the time. And that's not a walloping difference, right? 60-40. It's not 90-10. So there's a lot of overlap between men and women in terms of their levels of aggression. And you think, well, they're more the same. Yeah, except. So then let's say, no, let's play a slightly different game. Let's pick the 1 in 100 most aggressive person from the random population. Well, they're all men. And that's why all the people in prison are men. So even though on average, men and women.
Most.
Well, yeah, right. It's 90 to 95%, right? So, and often if the women are in prison, it's because they got tangled up with a really bad guy, you know. So one of the problems is that differences at the extreme are where the differences really start to manifest themselves. And so you can have a small difference at the level of the average, but out at the extremes, it starts to make a massive difference. So let's say to be a Google engineer, which is hard, right? Because you not only have to be an engineer, but you have to be a very good engineer. Say, well, you have to be interested in things rather than people. That's a huge difference in interest. Like men are more interested in things, generally speaking, and women are more interested in people, generally speaking. Now, there's still a lot of overlap between them, but that's one of the biggest differences between men and women. It's been demonstrated cross-culturally. It's also a very big difference in the Scandinavian countries. Well, on average, the difference isn't that great, even though it's a relatively large difference. But at the extremes, it's the same thing. Almost all the people are hyper-focused on things. They're almost all men. And all the people who are hyper-focused on people are almost all women. And so how does that play out in the world? Well, in the Scandinavian countries, it plays out this way. About 85% of nurses in Scandinavia are female. And about 85 to 90% of engineers are male. It doesn't mean women can't be engineers. It doesn't mean men can't be nurses. It also doesn't have anything to do with intelligence. But it does have to do with interest. And the differences in interest are big. Now, at the extremes in particular. So when you read a review like that, the one that was pointed out, the first question is, well, what do you mean by big and little? There's more overlap. There's more overlap between men and women than there is difference on virtually every parameter. Okay, fine. Are the remaining differences significant in how they play out in the world? And the answer to that is overwhelmingly significant because you select for extremes. So here's another example. Ashkenazi Jews have an average IQ of 115. So in the typical population overall has an average IQ of 100. 15 points is about the difference between the typical college student and the typical high school student. Okay, so it's not a massive difference, but if you go to the extreme, say, well, let's go look at people who only have an IQ of 145, which is kind of where you hit the beginnings of genius level. It's like the Jews are overwhelmingly overrepresented. So relatively small differences in the average can produce walloping differences at the extremes. And people don't understand that. It's not surprising because it actually requires a fairly sophisticated grasp of statistics. But when we're talking about things like differential outcome in the workplace, then you have to take a sophisticated statistical approach to it or you don't know what the hell you're talking about. And unfortunately, many of the people who are talking about things like gender differences, they have no idea what they're talking about. They don't know the literature. They don't know there is a literature. They don't understand biology, like the social constructionist types, the women's studies types, the neo-Marxists, they don't give a damn about biology. It's like they inhabit some disembodied universe. So the review was poorly written at best and showed a very poor grasp of the relationship between group differences and economic and practical outcomes.
It's not just that, it's deceptive. And there's a need in some way on that side, this side of the debate, the anti-Jordan Peterson side, to label men and women as being virtually identical when there's so much evidence that that's not the case. And what you're saying, what you've never said, one is superior, one is inferior. What you are is a guy who's pointing out the reality of the difference between the various types of human beings. And you've been very open about the extremes, about you. Look, I'm well aware of the extremes. I deal with MMA fighters. I know a lot of female MMA fighters. They're as aggressive and as tough as any man you're ever going to meet in your life. And I know a lot of men from comedy that are meek little guys who they're not nearly as aggressive as some of these female fighters. Like, I think one of the beautiful things about freedom is that people get an opportunity to express themselves in a way that's genuinely them.
Yep.
And whether that is like our friend Alex Honnold, who's a free climber, who is like climbing up these fantastic mountains with no ropes, or whether it's a female MMA fighter like Raquel Pennington, who's just a tank and beating the shit out of people, and that's what she loves to do. All of these extremes are available to people because of freedom. This is not a suppressive thing. No one's stopping people from choosing these paths. I don't know if you saw the most recent slip up by the CEO of YouTube. I retweeted it today. They were talking about why there's not as many women in tech, and she basically said, they both, her and the CEO of Google, said exactly what James Damore was saying in his memo. They completely fucked up. They tried to, did you find this? Look at this. This is goddamn hilarious, and James Damore had this on his page. They respond, women, a lack of tech is critical. No, go to James Damore's tweet. Just go to the what I retweeted and what he said.
So there was a study published a while ago about...
Jamie, scroll back up. Right, it was right there. It's right there. Just make his tweet larger. There you go. Look, see, he's saying, did I read this right? I don't know how to say her name. Is Susan Wojcicki? I'm sorry, I don't know how to say her name. Wojcicki said that women find geeky male industries, as opposed to social industries, not very interesting, and Sundar cites research on gender differences.
Yeah, well, that's exactly the difference in interest that I just pointed out. That's
exactly
right.
Yes, and this is what James Damore wrote in his memo that got him fired.
Yeah, yeah.
And this, in my mind, if I was the lawyer for James Damore, I'd be like, oh, well, look what we have here. This is checkmate.
Yeah.
You dummies, you know, just said what he said.
The DeMore story is really interesting, you know, because I think it's such a classic story of an engineer getting tangled up in politics. So DeMore went to this diversity seminar, and he wasn't very happy about it because he knew the literature. And so at the end of the seminar, they asked for feedback. Well, James DeMore is an engineer. So when you tell an engineer that you want feedback, the engineer thinks, oh, you want feedback, and you want, like, facts and stuff, right? Because that's what feedback would be like. So DeMore went and wrote this like thorough memo and gave it to them. He said, well, you know, this is what I think. Here's some feedback. And then it traveled around. He got no real response from the diversity people. And then he posted it on one of these internal boards at Google where people can discuss things, which people at Google do all the time. So it was perfectly reasonable for him to post it because he didn't get a response from the diversity people. He thought, well, let's see what other people think. And then it was there for a long time until it was leaked into the outside world. It wasn't like DeMore was trying to expose Google for what it is. He was just doing what an engineer type would do when someone asked him to provide feedback, because he's not thinking politically. He's not thinking, oh, they just want to hear what they already said. He thought they actually wanted some facts. Anyways, I think they picked on the wrong guy, because DeMore turns out to be pretty damn tough.
Well, he's very smart and a very kind guy. Yeah. When you sit down and talk to him, he's not a sexist. He's a guy that's talking about facts. In fact, he wrote more than a page and a half, I believe, on strategies for getting more women interested in tech. He's not a sexist.
Yeah.
This is just a guy that was talking about the differences and the choices that people make, that it's based on just the variations that you were just discussing.
Yeah. Well, there's a good study done a while ago, and unfortunately I don't remember the author, but they were looking at junior high math prodigies. And they're pretty equally distributed between boys and girls. But by the time university came along, the math prodigy boys, they tend to go into the STEM fields, but the girls wouldn't. And it isn't because they lacked ability, because they had stellar ability. It's because they weren't interested. And it turns out, like, the interest thing turns out to be a big one. So with personality alone, if you measure men and women's personalities, and then you add up all the differences in personalities, you could tell with about 75 to 80% certainty by looking at a full personality readout whether a person's male or female. So you'd be wrong 25% of the time, something like that. But if you add interest to that, you can get it up to about 90%. And so, you know, you say, well, are these differences large? Well, individually, they're not that big. They make more difference at the extremes. But if you add them up, then you can almost completely differentiate men from women. So by that token, they're very large. And the interest thing actually turns out to matter a lot. Like, it's probably the most important individual difference that has been discovered between men and women at the psychological level. It has real decent explanatory power, because you might say, well, men have a slight edge in spatial intelligence, and that's why they're overrepresented in STEM fields. And women have a slight edge in verbal intelligence. This is debatable, but literature kind of indicates that. And that's why they're overwhelmingly the majority of fiction readers, for example. Is that the reason that there's differential representation in the STEM fields? It's like, no, it doesn't seem to be. It doesn't look like it's an intellectual issue, which is also what DeMore pointed out, by the way. He never said once that this was a cognitive issue. But it's a matter of choice. matter of interest. And women tend to be more people-oriented. Now, the thing is, this has also been discovered in chimpanzees and other primates. Like if you offer baby or child chimpanzees, juvenile chimpanzees, the choice between thing-like toys, like cars, or people-like toys, like dolls, the males will go for the thing-like toys and the females will go for the people-like toys. So you see that in primates. And you think, well, is that surprising? It's like, well, no, it's not. It's not that surprising, really. I mean, women have to take care of infants, tiny infants. And you have to be really people-oriented to do that because a tiny infant is an unbelievably demanding social relationship. And it's a primary relationship for about 2 years, you know. And so women are tilted towards the kind of temperament that makes that possible. It's like, well, is that such a shock? Really? That's such a surprise? So,
no,
yeah.
It's not a surprise. And what's confusing to me is the narrative that anybody that points out these differences is somehow a sexist or discriminatory worse.
Well, whatever epithet they can. Well, I think the other reason that the radical lefties have been going after me constantly is, well, there's one reason is if you stand up against the radical left, you're in a group that also has Nazis in it, because the Nazis also stand up against the radical left. Mm. So it's perfectly reasonable from a strategic perspective for the radical leftists to say, well, you're against us. How do we know you're not a Nazi? It's like, well, statistically, I'm probably not, you know, so there's that. But you could say at least the question is open. But then the next part of it comes is that it's motivated epithet slinging, because if I'm reasonable and I'm standing up against the radical left and they admit that I'm reasonable, then there has to be an admission that reasonable people could stand up against the radical left, which kind of implies that the radical left isn't that reasonable. And so while they're not going to go there, of course, they're not that reasonable. They're unreasonable beyond belief, as we saw in the situation with Lindsay Shepherd in Canada. So at Wilfrid Laurier University.
Yeah, let's talk about that real quick, because that was a fascinating thing too. And that also had to do with you. So she was discussing you in class, and you could fill in everybody.
She's in the communications department at Wilfrid Laurier, and they were talking about the role of language in communication, which is kind of what you would do in a communication class. And she decided to show a 5-minute clip from a program I had done for TV Ontario, which is a public television station, mainstream, left-leaning, liberal television station, news program, and a good one. And I had been on there with a number of other people, including a professor, Nicholas Matt, from the University of Toronto, who claimed essentially that there were no biological differences between men and women, and that had been the scientific consensus for the last 4 decades. So anyways, she showed a clip from this, and, well, she got hauled in front of two professors and an administrator, Adria Joel, who was basically hired for that purpose and raked over the coals for daring to show this video. And she had the wherewithal to tape it. And then she made the tape public. And in that tape, they compared me. It was really blackly comical, you know. They compared me to Hitler.
Yeah.
But then said, well, it's Hitler or Milo Yiannopoulos. And I thought, you guys, you're so damn clueless, you can't even get your insults right. It's like, you can't say, that's like playing a video of Hitler or Milo Yiannopoulos. It's like, first of all, Hitler and Milo Yiannopoulos, they're actually not in the same category, right? Except that they're both human. That's about the narrowness of the category. And then Milo's like a comic provocateur, and you can hate him or love him or be indifferent. But to put him in the same category as Hitler just shows how muddle-headed you are. And then to assimilate me to that category so carelessly. Like, you don't mess about with epithets like that. You know, Hitler was one of the great supervillains of the 20th century, right? I mean, he's up there with Stalin and Mao in the panoply of satanically possessed leaders. You don't just toss that around, especially not when you're torturing your teaching assistant for daring to show a video about language in a communication class. And so that was a massive scandal in Canada. It was the biggest, I think it was the biggest scandal that ever hit a university in Canada. And it got a lot of international attention, and rightly so. And she also turns out to be a tough cookie. I mean, the last I heard, she'd started a club at Wilfrid Laurier, and I think it was last night or the night before, maybe it's coming up, they're going to show the whole video from Television Ontario at a club meeting and invite people to come and discuss it. It's like they picked on the wrong girl there, too.
So well, they certainly did. She's obviously very smart. You can hear that in her discussion with them and how flabbergasted she was by their take on things. But this was essentially proof to a lot of people that were on the outside of how preposterous some of the dialogue was inside these universities.
And well, they couldn't have done me a bigger favor than having that scandal, because when I made a videos about Bill C-16 15 months ago, I said, look, here's what's going to happen, because this legislation is written in an appalling manner and the surrounding policies are pathological. I said, here's what's going to happen. And so I laid it out. And then people came out and said, no, you're being paranoid. It's like, that's possible. No, the bill, the legislation isn't going to have that effect. No, you're not a legal expert. What the hell do you know? Et cetera, et cetera. You're crazy. You're a bigot. You're a transphobe. You know, they threw everything but the kitchen sink at me. And like, fair enough, you know, because there's always a possibility that I was wrong. But the problem was, is I read the policies and I understood them and I knew where they were leading. But I never imagined that one of the consequences of Bill C-16 and its sister legislation was that a teaching assistant at a Canadian university would be pilloried and accused of breaking the law and then accused of all sorts of reprehensible political beliefs by two professors and an administrator hired for that purpose, merely because she showed a video about two people talking about the law. It's like that paranoid as I am, let's say, that exceeded the grasp or the reach of my imagination. And then, of course, it was made public and people just couldn't believe it. And then you think, okay, well, what's the defense? Well, they misinterpreted Bill C-16. It's like, no, I don't think so. They aren't representative of the university professor and administration. Well, all of Pimlott and Rambukana's colleagues rose to their defense, the whole department. The university, when they apologized, did it in a very mealy-mouthed way. Like, there's no evidence that it was an anomalous occurrence. So what had happened is they overextended the reach of Bill C-16 in exactly the way that I said would happen. It was inevitable. And it wasn't an anomaly. It was actually, that's actually the way that the universities are. And it is the way that they are. It wasn't a one-off. It was exactly diagnostic. And it's appalling. It's appalling. The universities have so much to be ashamed of. Well, there was an article in the Boston Globe this week saying the same thing, that all of this crazy postmodern identity politics, equality of outcome nonsense is not only disrupted the university in a way that might be irreparable, as far as I can tell, but it's rapidly spreading outside into the normal, say, business world, which was exactly what you see, for example, at Google.
Well, the tech industry in particular seems to be like more left-leaning than pretty much any industry there is. And I guess it's because there's so many intelligent people there, so many people that have spent a tremendous amount of time in universities, and they get indoctrinated into this mindset. And you're seeing that in this, the CEO of YouTube's response to the James Damore memo completely misrepresented it. They're talking about harmful gender stereotypes. That's not what he talked about at all. What's fascinating to me about all of this is it just reeks of tribalism, that these people on the left have decided, I mean, and I'm mostly on the left, which is really crazy. I mean, when it comes to most policies and most thoughts of equality and the idea of just letting people be who they are. I mean, that's what the left used to stand for. It used to stand for being open-minded. It used to stand for being a reasonable person. Now it seems to be all about this very toxic tribal ideology, and this is one of the reasons why so many of these attacks on you are so baffling to me, is because there's a willful ignorance or a deceptive narrative. There's a deceptive description of who you are and what you're saying and what you represent. And it's this conveniently categorized, not even convenient, willfully deceptively categorized into these categories of homophobia, transphobia, sexism. These are reprehensible categories that if they can just shove something that you're saying, figure out a way to push you into this little narrow confine, then everyone has to disagree with you. Everyone has to insult you. And everyone has to, like, take that girl into their office and chastise you for even using, not even speaking up for you.
Right.
Just which, using.
And she said she wasn't.
Yes. That's what was more fascinating mm-hmm. about it than anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, then they give her hell for that. Like, well, you can't present something like that neutrally. That's like presenting something Hitler said neutrally. Or maybe Milo Yiannopoulos.
It's so strange. But what they don't understand, and this is what's really crazy, is that the world is watching, and that most people, maybe it's a 60-40 like we were talking about before when it comes to aggressive women versus aggressive men. I don't know what the number is.
I think it's about 50-1, actually. Like, I've been watching the comments on YouTube and so forth trying to track this. It's like, I think that what the radical leftists are doing is overwhelmingly unrepresentative of the general population.
Yeah.